Welcome back to another episode of Political Football, a political football mini, if you will, a short, sharp, special edition after the weekend's voice referendum. You were played in there by the wonderful and late Archie Roach, and one of his seminal pieces, Took the Children Away, referring to the stolen generations there. I was fortunate enough to see Archie Roach in person just on a side note a few years ago. With Mum, one of the great storytellers of Australian music, and you can tell the pain and suffering in his voice, and I thought that was quite a fair and adequate play in given the events of the weekend. If you haven't caught up with it, or if you've been living under a rock, unfortunately, the voice referendum and constitutional recognition for Aboriginal people in the constitution was defeated. The national vote looking around 60.5% to 39.5%. With the no vote carrying in every state and territory, minus the ACT. Obviously, a very disappointing result for those who knew me. Obviously, soundly on supporter of the Yes campaign and the Yes vote, I should say. And yeah, just it's quite staggering. And again, for me, I feel very disappointed, but I can't imagine the hurt that some of our Indigenous brothers and sisters are going through at the moment. So give my thoughts to them. And I look through it with a positive lens. Nearly 7 million Australians did vote yes, but unfortunately, majority on a path for 7 million Australians around that mark to have voted yes when the final vote is counted. But the majority, especially in outer suburban areas and regional areas, voted no. And it's very disappointing. So I suppose the way that we'll do this in terms of the analysis, I'll run through a quick breakdown of the voting trends, what happened where, and try and dig into some of the reasons why and how, and then dig into some of the misnomers again that have been reported, again, much like the previous in the lead-up to the campaign, propagated by largely one side of the affair and helped along by a fourth estate, which seemed to abrogate its responsibility to fair and frank reporting, which seems to be much more common these days. But hey, at least you got Political Football here to call it out where you see it. And then we'll finish off with some analysis, some interesting insights I've read from different people across the spectrum. So we'll go there. But let's get going now with the key voting trends. So first one here, and I've taken this from The Guardian, Catherine Murphy, and one of her esteemed colleagues have done some research and analysis on the breakdown by the community and how they voted. So as is to be expected, coalition voting electorates had a much lower yes vote with only one seat nationally of theirs. I think it was about 58. So don't quote me on that. Around that mark, who voted yes, and that was Bradfield, which is up Hornsby way. For those of you listening interstate or internationally, which there are thousands. So, yeah, and they had a much lower yes vote as well compared to other electorates, which managed to have voted no. But, yeah, so that's no surprise. Obviously, the coalition came out with a position after the Aston by-election, contrary to the one they took to the prior election and one that Scott Morrison took into the 2019 election, committing to a voice to Parliament, of which he commissioned two reports over 700 pages with Marcia Langdon and Tom Carmer, but instead decided to put his praying hands on Ken White and offer his prayers to Brother Stewie. Yeah, we'll see how that goes when the Anti-Corruption Commission gets a hold of Brother Stewie. Anyway, that's a side note there. Again, this is going to be my rawest. I haven't got my side hustle, my calming impact, Mr. Joe Boyden. But if there's any time to be a bit more direct, tonight is the night. That was it in the coalition seats. The teal seats were one of the shining lights for the yes vote. So they represented some of the highest votes, yes votes in the electorate. So Wentworth, so eastern suburbs of Sydney, North Sydney, Goldstein, Melbourne, that's Greens, but those inner city teal seats that the LNP really needs to win back if they are to form government. They were clearly a majority yes vote, and it sort of went to a voting trend that correlated with education level. So that's an interesting one to dissect. Number of university bachelor degree qualifications, seemed the high number of those in the electorate, the higher the yes vote seemed to be. So that was an interesting one. An interesting one for the Labor heartland. A lot of the Labor heartland said no. So obviously when you have such a resounding no vote, the coalition might have carried a lot of that. But I think it was only like 17 of 78 Labor electorates had a majority yes vote. Some of the big ones that had big no votes include the Hunter Valley and the seat of Paterson, which is next door to it. So these are, traditionally Labor strongholds up there in coal mining country. The seat of Blair in Queensland, which is, I think, Ipswich, had 30% yes vote. It was a similar picture in Rankin, which was the electorate held by Treasurer Jim Chalmers. So again, we're talking about working class areas there, 35% yes. And similar, even in Western Melbourne's Western Suburbs, had 36% of the vote in the seat of Hawke. And a lot of the same for Western Sydney. I'm very disappointed that my seat of Reed looks like it's going to skew to a no vote, around 53-47. The pre-poll numbers were a bloodbath, but on the day vote was quite strong. I'll take solace. I would like it to be a higher yes vote, but down at 5, the public school where I was handing out for the majority of the day was around 53-47, 54-46, final numbers yet to be counted, to be confirmed, but also that would be around that number, I should say. That was that. And then, so really interesting in the seat of Reed, right, because you've got sort of, really areas that were traditionally working class, but because, you're within 6-7 k's of the city, you've seen asset price inflation over 30 years jack up. And so places like Des Moines, Five Dock, Abbotsford, which historically would be the more blue parts of the electorate compared to Burwich, Strathfield, Homebush West, the more west part of the electorate, more multicultural, more diverse area of the electorate, which would be more red at a general election, was actually sort of roles reversed. Des Moines, Abbotsford, Five Dock had multiple yes booths, and then those areas where Burwich is big, Chinese community in Burwood, Strathfield, a big Korean population, and then Concord and other areas, would have, and some parts of Five Dock and Abbotsford and Des Moines, traditionally, quite a big Greek and Italian community around here as well. But that probably skew more to the no vote as well. And that was my experience from handing out on the day. It's good to compare the empirical evidence to what you experienced. And certainly I noticed a lot of young families taking yes pamphlets. A lot of young people were clearly on the side of yes, whereas the older population definitely skewed to the no vote. And that's shown through in the polling leading up to it. And I'm sure that'll show up in further analysis going into it as well. Going back to that point in relation to the further you're going out of the city, the more likely you are to get a no vote. Inner metropolitan areas, there was 19 no seats, 26 yes seats, so you had a majority of that. Outer metropolitan and provincial was a bloodbath, so you had 38 no seats to 5 yes seats, and then a provincial 23 to 2, and then rural was 38-0. So absolutely bloodbath as you go further out of the city. There was clearly a divide there. Some analysis from Cos Samaras, who's a pollster, said that the culturally linguistically diverse campaign for the yes side was non-existent, and it's hard to say otherwise in relation to how those results manifested. And obviously when there's disinformation out there and there's a vacuum there to be filled, especially around things about, how long was the Uluru Statement of the Heart, and it was a thing about, one of the people handing out was saying, vote no for the voice for division, or division by race, or some rubbish like that. That has the ability to fill that vacuum, and clearly people fell into that. And it was a convenient excuse for them to use to vote no. So, yeah, that's my take on that. Another piece of analysis that I came across on Twitter, which I found was a very interesting piece, is a chart that mapped the yes vote in the Voice referendum against the Republic referendum in 1999. And there's a large correlation there of the yes vote in this referendum was a bit lower than the referendum in 1999, which also got defeated. But again, it was a large correlation, positive correlation between yes vote there and the yes vote here. So the blue, the coalition seats, much lower vote in both of those. And then as you go up the chart, imagine going along the x-axis and going up, there is there was a much greater proportion of greater share of Labour electorates that had a higher share of yes in both referendums and also Greens as well. So I found that really interesting. And he sort of did some analysis and tied it to education levels in the community, proportion of women in the workforce, young people and renters as a share of the population, and then support for independent candidates and minor parties. So that was really interesting. The other misnomer that I wanted to quickly nail on the head was that some of the early analysis coming out, especially when the Northern Territory came out with a majority no vote, was that confirmed that Indigenous people didn't want it. That couldn't be further from the truth. Indigenous communities, Indigenous voting booths across the country had a clear support for it, well above 70% in a lot of places. The community of Palm Island in the Queensland electorate of Herbert has an Indigenous population of 91% at the last census and had a yes vote of 75.1% compared to the overall vote in the electorate of Herbert of just 24%. So I think that's up near Townsville. And it's inclusive of Townsville and Palm Island just off the coast there. So Mornington Island as well, which is off the in the Gulf of Carpentaria within the seat of Kennedy, has an Indigenous population of over 80% and delivered a highest yes votes, one of the highest votes in Queensland at 78%. Obviously, Queensland was one of the worst results as well, not surprising. And similar with in Cairns, Yarrabah has an Indigenous population of 95%. Its yes vote was almost 76%, while the yes vote in Kennedy was less than 20%. So that's a case of there. In the Northern Territory, one place where I take great delight of, given that Jacinta Price was one of the proponents of the No campaign and clearly has a very loose relationship with the truth, or at worst, a very deliberate intention to divide the community and pretend to represent people that she's not. And I don't care, I'm happy to say that it's clearly the evidence supports that, even as far as on Saturday night where she was questioning some of the credentials of Australian Electoral Commission staff working on remote polling booths in Lingiari, which is in Northern Territory, and has Indigenous residents 40% as a total share, and traditionally been one of the lowest turnouts at elections, but just over 2/3 of people in Lingiari, I think, voted yes. I'm reading this article. 72% packing the Voice, yes. Whereas the vote across all of Lingiari was 42%. So, again, a plus 30 differential there. And so I was just reading through Shane Wright, who, again, did some very good analysis and one of the good guys in the media, if you will, in terms of using facts and evidence. Who would have thought that would be a good idea if you're a journalist? So that's some of the misnomers I wanted to dispel there, that there was Indigenous community that didn't support the Voice. It clearly did. It was the rest of the country that clearly let it down, especially in those outer suburban regional seats where the misinformation or disinformation seemed to take off like wildfire. Moving on now to some analysis, just before we wrap up here, because you're probably, if you're still listening, you've had enough of my voice, it could probably put you to sleep. But it's clear that the lack of bipartisanship torpedoed the chance of the Voice getting up. And for me, you know, that's heartbreaking and everything, but for me, that my heart goes out most to the people who went through the 7 years or the 8 years worth of this process of the Uluru dialogues, the regional dialogues, getting out into the communities and asking what people wanted, getting over 1,000 co-signatories on the Uluru Statement of the Heart from all over the country, people like Megan Davis, Marcia Langton, who was, other names escape me at the moment, Noel Pearson, Thomas Mayo, the likes, I'm sure I'm forgetting some names there, you know, the work of Linda Burney and Ken White and everyone else who's been involved over the last 7 or 8 years, and at various times there's been bipartisan support. But Peter Dutton made a clear choice after the Aston by-election that he was going to become the head of the Noalition and become the Trump without charisma, to quote Catherine Murphy. And he saw this as a chance to make himself relevant again, in the hopes of getting himself elected at the next election. Because only a couple of weeks before the Aston by-election, if you recall, he came out and apologised for walking out on the apology to the Stolen Generations back in 2008 when Kevin Rudd issued it. But then had a clear change of strategy and just started attacking it. And then it became a vacuum where certain parts of the media would just run with media content, even if it was just completely false, or would just run with it and give adequate attention to the no side, to the yes side. Now, I'm all about balance, right? But there's a difference between balance and actually basing things in fact and giving time the light of things to the light of day that deserve to be and things not to be, right? I'm all for people having the ability to have a respectful discussion where they disagree. But it used to be a time, but I think, you know, there was a common sense of, you know, facts used to matter. I think we are living in a post-truth world, and that aspect of social media and the 24-hour news cycle seems to add fuel to the fire, where someone says something, it runs, and then another thing puts on top. And for me, this has just confirmed it. And I think we held it off for a while compared to the US and the UK, but I think with the voice referendum, it certainly took it to a new level. And unfortunately, it's Indigenous brothers and sisters who will again pay the price for it. Again, all this voice referendum was about was Aboriginal people wanting a say in decisions that affect them. They're the ones who are less likely to live to the average age by the average life expectancy by 8 years. If you're a young Aboriginal man, you're more likely to go to prison than you are to go to university. You're more likely to be in out-of-home care. All the social and economic metrics that we used to talk about closing the gap, this was a practical measure that was in response to that. Ironically, and I think this was Peter Malinauskas who made this point on Q&A last week. Now, I'm not a Q&A watcher, but I did come across it on my feed, in which he said that the voice to Parliament was actually a solution to the Conservative zeitgeist, saying that in relation to the recognition movement getting off the ground, that would be too symbolic, and that the voice was actually a practical step you could do, that you could take to getting Aboriginal people into better decision-making processes, and then ultimately, obviously, closing the gap between some of these key metrics that we look at. So to say they didn't come out and support it, or they would have supported constitutional recognition, when clearly it was just a political game they were playing, is nothing short of ridiculous. And I hope it gives them false hope ahead of the next election. But I do think that we could do better than this in terms of how we contest the debate in the country. And I know it didn't turn out well for Anthony Albanese. You could say that there was mistakes made along the way in terms of the campaign and how it was run and that sort of thing. But you've got to admire the political courage. He said he would do this going into the election. He ran it. He showed some courage. There might have been some misjudgments along the way in relation to just how much support he thought he could rally for the voice without bipartisanship. But in saying that, he did hold 7 meetings with Peter Dutton ahead of it, which he asked none of the questions that he seemed to be posing in front of the media. So, that's my take on that. It clearly performed poorly amongst immigrant groups or culturally, linguistically diverse groups. Places like Western Sydney, Labor held seats like McMahon, Watson, the other ones who escaped me at the moment, but it was clearly nothing west of Greenland. The Prime Minister's electorate really voted yes. Obviously, it was quite close in my electorate of Reid and also in Bennelong, but that was clearly an indifferent result there too. So that's two things now where sort of social issues haven't performed particularly well amongst immigrant communities. Again, you could put that down to maybe a lack of clarity from the Yes campaign into those communities. But that's an interesting one alongside, like, people have they traditionally vote on economic and political lines against how they vote on social matters like this. So that's an interesting one, and I think that was Wonderful forward. And I was reading a great article today from Sean Kelly, author of The Game, Peter Scott Morrison's biography came out last year. But it was clearly that, you referenced Marcy Ellington, who I mentioned earlier, said that a majority of Australians said no to an invitation with a minimal proposition. And that's what it was. It was overcomplicated in terms of what's a voice and all this detailed stuff, remnants of stuff they recycled in 1999 with the with referendum on the Republic, you know, which model we're going to go with, all that rubbish. This is a proposition for the Constitution. It's a principle-based document. It's not a piece of it's not like a piece of legislation that goes through and details it like that. That was a responsibility for the Parliament. So when government changes, things can be updated in relation to the model. But what could not be changed was that the voice existed, because when Aboriginal people have had a representative body in the past, a new government has come in, and because it's just been by legislation, they've rescinded it and it's been removed, and any progress that was made or any progress that was intended to be made was struck out by new priorities and new agendas, and you can't fix generational issues without generational addressing them properly, and not, short-term political fixes, it's like giving funding for 1 to 2 years for a program for something that's probably going to take 7 to 8 years to effect meaningful change. So that was that. And a couple other things here from Sean Kelly. Talked about the referendum not having bipartisan support and how that made it dead in the water. And a quote here, he says, "We are talking about flagrant lies designed to divide the nation by race. What emboldens those who tell such lies is the media's failure to call them out." Again, going to my point earlier about the Fourth Estate and its abrogation of some responsibility to be able to call facts from opinion. As a nation, we have to prove ourselves incapable of having a mature conversation about Indigenous Australians, which also means a conversation about the rest of us. And I think that's a really good point. Thanks to Mum's involvement in the Indigenous community, I've met some Indigenous people and made some friends there. But if it wasn't for Mum's involvement being a champion for what she does, and like so many people, other people out there who do wonderful things like the Torch, Rumbalara Football Netball Club, and other great initiatives that I've been a part of in the past, AIM, Engineering Aid Australia, all these wonderful organisations that do grassroots stuff, and we'll continue to do it, right? Doers are doers, talkers are talkers, right? The talkers seem to dominate the media. Doers are actually out there doing stuff, and they're the ones who will affect change. And they'll continue to do that, and I'm sure the Prime Minister and Cabinet will come to some sort of solution to try and get some consultation and some real change going. Speaking to some friends, like growing up in my area, there would be no Indigenous kids that I went to school with. Maybe one or two that have some remnants, but you certainly wouldn't know about it unless you actively sought it out. And again, it goes back to Noel Pearson's point that I think in one of his speech earlier last year when the voice was getting off the ground, that Aboriginal people are the most unloved people in the country. And that again goes to show the result of the weekend that they are. People think that their own their own misfortune is because of their own actions, when clearly that is not the case. It's systemic, right? While I'll get a fine for a parking ticket, an Indigenous person might go to prison for it, right? There's empirical evidence to back this up. The stats clearly show it. And clearly, we have an issue with that in reconciling our past. So it's an ugly truth, but one we must continually address. And I hope going forward that we can find some common ground and continue to go forward. So that's where I'll leave it for tonight. I hope that's been a okay breakdown for you, and a lot of flow of thoughts have been coming through my mind as I've been doing this. A lot of things, different points you can look at it from, but that's my perspective, and I hope that helps you make some sense of it. And thinking of all our Indigenous brothers and sisters who have had to deal with this burden over the last, especially 6 months worth of campaigning and whatever it's been, and the result on the weekend. But, fingers crossed we can go towards a better future with Aboriginal people at the centre of it. Because, as the great Bob Hawke said, Australia is a great country, but there's one big black stain on our history, and that's our treatment of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So I'll leave you with that. And go well this week, and I hope everyone has a great week. Thanks very much.